The Psychoanalysis Podcast explores the ways that horror movies examine mental health issues. It deals with mature and sometimes disturbing subject matter, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. It is meant for entertainment purposes only, and not as a substitute for proper therapy. If you or a loved one are currently experiencing mental health difficulties, please contact your local mental health center.
Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Breathe in.
Breathe out.
This is Psychoanalysis.
This is Psychoanalysis, a horror therapy podcast analyzing the horror genre through the lens of mental health. I'm Jen Adams.
I'm Mike Snoonian.
And we are continuing to work through our Patreon request episodes, and we've got a heavy hitter today. We are going to be talking about The Night House. Yay! So here's a spoiler warning. Due to the content of this movie, we are going to be talking about grief, depression, and suicide. If that's something you are especially sensitive to, you might just want to skip this entire episode. I'm going to make sure to put timestamps in the show notes so you can skip maybe our mental health discussion or, you know, just go up to our feelings check and then peace out. Whatever you decide to do, we completely understand. If this isn't the episode for you, we still love you and we will see you next week. But we wanted to give that warning before we start. And this is also a Patreon request by William. So huge thank you to you for suggesting this movie.
Thank you, William. Thank you.
All right. And so now we are going to give a brief synopsis in case you haven't seen The Night House or it's been a while. There are pics of another synopsis that looks almost like this one on your phone, but it's not this synopsis. We actually don't know who it is. And I'm going to say before we start, it's hard to do the visual language of this film justice by telling you what happens. So I highly recommend you actually watch this movie too, because it's just gorgeous. All right. So we open on a beautiful lake house filled with pictures of a happy couple. Beth gets back from her husband Owen's funeral and angrily trashes the casserole a friend gave to her. Later that night, she drinks wine and watches videos of their wedding. She's in bed when she's startled by a knock at the door. No one's there, but a door seems to open on its own with the outline of a man standing behind it. On her way to work, she notices a gate unlatched and muddy footprints leading up to the dock steps to her house. They seem to come straight out of the water, then she hears a gunshot. Beth is a high school teacher. The year is over, and she shows up to a teacher in-service day.
Question for you. Is this common to have an in-service day after school is over? Because our school, when we're done, we're done.
Oh, we usually have at least one or two in-service days.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to close up our rooms.
Oh, fuck that noise. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I actually had a tragedy happen on the last day of school one year and had to miss that day and then come back later in the summer to do all of my packing. And like, I have a whole checklist. You have to like sign your keys back in and everything. So, yeah.
But like an actual like service training, or is it just pack your shit and go?
So it's a little of both sometimes, depending on what's coming, you know, depending on what principal I had too. So. Lots of times we'll have like a teacher lunch and they'll like give us our gifts. And so it's kind of more like a celebration. But no, I have never had one where it's like, hey, here's what we did wrong yesterday. Right. You know? Yeah. So that was maybe a little much. Although I have been assigned books to read over the summer on the last day of school. Mm-hmm. Yep. We had a summer book club. Yep. Did not read those books.
So. Was it optional?
It was highly
suggested. I'm sorry to sidetrack it, but it was just like, this is just bizarre. Like, the most bizarre thing in the movie to me is this training.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It felt like every training I've ever been to. Not exactly like the last day, but I mean, that would not be unheard of at the school I came from. So Beth is sitting in her classroom browsing new houses with shockingly low prices when she drowses off. The mom of one of her students has come to quibble with her about his grade. Her sweet little angel got a C in speech because he didn't bother to do his last presentation. It's a totally bullshit excuse.
Can't wait to talk about this scene.
Oh, yes. She offers to excuse the grade, but the mom isn't happy. She wants to put Beth in her place for daring to give her son consequences for his actions. Beth shuts her down by telling her what happened to Owen. He took the boat out into the middle of the lake and shot himself. Back at home, her neighbor Mel comes to talk to her. His wife recently passed away, and she and Owen were very supportive. He feels protective of Beth. She notices that the footsteps are gone, and Mel did not hear a gunshot that morning. Turns out her husband Owen was an architect who built their home, very hotly. While looking through his book of design plans, Beth notices ominous notes saying to trick it and designs for a reverse floor plan that might be a second house. In the middle of the night, the stereo turns itself on and starts playing their song. She notices a text from Owen saying, "Come down, don't be afraid." She calls the number and hears only a staticky voice telling her to look out the window. Owen is out there standing on the water. Beth wakes up on the floor and writes it off as a dream. Later, she looks through his personal effects and checks his phone. The texts aren't there, but when browsing through his pictures, she notices a photo of a girl in a bookstore who looks just like her. Beth shows her friend Claire, who's also a teacher at the school. Claire thinks it is her, but says no matter what happened, everyone has secrets. She should remember the Owen she knew and let the rest go. Later, she's out drinking with Claire and some other teachers, and they're complaining about the principal, and I just wrote, been there, and she tells them she thinks there's a ghost in her house. They think it might be sleep paralysis or sleepwalking. It turns out Owen used to sleepwalk. It started shortly after they built the house. They ask her if she knew anything was wrong with Owen, and she says she didn't. She's the one who had suicidal thoughts, and he's the one who helped her through them. They awkwardly try to talk about it, and Beth brings out the note he left her. She's been keeping it in her purse. She reads it at the table, and it says, "You were right. There is nothing. Nothing is after you. You are safe now." Beth is clearly struggling, and Claire takes her home. She's worried about her all by herself and invites her over for dinner. Beth says she lied. She does know what the note means. When she was 17, she flipped her car off the side of a mountain. Her heart stopped for 4 minutes. When people ask her what she saw when she was dead, she would say she didn't remember, but she does remember. And Owen was the only person she ever told. She says there's nothing, no light at the end of the tunnel, but Owen wanted to believe in a better place. Beth falls asleep in Claire's lap, but wakes up to the stereo blaring static. She goes out to the lake and sees girls running and disappearing over the side of the cliff, the third of which gives me a heart attack. The girls aren't there in the water, but she notices the lights of a house across the lake. Someone whispers the word boat in her ear. When she goes down to the dock, the boat has remnants of her husband's death. When she looks again, they're gone, but a pair of bloody footprints are on the dock. She asks Owen to show her if he's really there and then notices two more footprints. She reaches out and something seems to overtake her and she falls into the boat. Beth wakes up on the opposite shore and sees a house just like hers. The lights are on inside and she sees herself looking out the window while someone whispers that it's a dream. It's not her. It's several different women that all look like her and Owen is with them. She opens the door and it's daytime. She's asleep on her own couch, but the door is open. And this is another moment where it's just really difficult to actually explain what you're seeing. So, So just make sure to watch it because it's really great. Beth begins to go through the pictures on Owen's phone and finds a folder named Other. It's more pictures of this woman and many more women who look just like her. As she explores the woods, she runs into Mel on a trail. Mel says there are no houses out there. It's county land and he can't build on it. He's worried about her walking in the woods and asks her if she has anyone to lean on. Beth keeps walking and finds the second house about half finished. Inside, she finds a tiny statue of a woman in a stress position with spikes driven through her body. She goes to Mel's place and asks him what the statue is. She thinks he was trying to keep her out of the woods. Mel says he saw Owen wandering around in the middle of the night from time to time, and Owen asked him not to tell her. Turns out, Mel caught him taking that same route around the lake. He had a woman who looked like her with him. Then he came over drunk and disheveled later that night, said he had shameful urges that he was trying to shake, and he'd found a way to keep them at bay. Mel says Owen left a hole in Beth's life and she's desperate to fill it. And he says that she doesn't need to fill it with something dark. Later, looking through Owen's things, she finds a book labeled Kedroya. No word. A word that she noticed written in Owen's design books. There are notes about how to confuse or weaken the dark forces and pictures of the statue she found. Beth begins to hear footsteps on the floor above her. It looks like a dark figure standing in the house, but then it's gone. The next day, she drives to the bookstore where Owen bought the book and his sketchbook. The clerk can't really tell her anything helpful, but she notices the woman from his photo wandering through the stacks. Her name is Madeline, and she had a mild flirtation with Owen after meeting him in the store. Later, she tells Claire about this, but she can't understand what it was about. Claire says to stop going through Owen's stuff. Nothing she finds is going to be of any help. But Beth tells her that she felt him. Back at the house, Beth announces to no one that she's leaving and that if he has something to say, he should say it now. Then she hears a knock on the door, which also gave me a heart attack. Madeline is at the door. The two have a drink and Madeline spills the whole story. She says Owen came by the store one afternoon and invited her to the house as a sort of day trip. They had a drink and walked to the lake and he showed her the other house, then asked her to hold the weird statue. He held her and started crying. Then they kissed and it turned violent and he started to choke her. She asked him to stop and he did, then drove her home. She says he said he was tired and said it wasn't working anymore. He was afraid he couldn't hold it back. He knew what he had to do. He had to end it for good, which, given what we know about Owen, has a more ominous tone than I think she understands it to have. Madeline leaves, and Beth has another drink. She goes out in the rain looking for the house, saying she's not leaving until they talk. Under the floorboards of the second house, she finds a body wrapped in plastic. Several bodies, actually. She runs back to the house and calls Claire, but Claire does not answer. While Beth takes a shower, the music starts playing again, then abruptly stops. Beth cries for him to come back and sobs on the floor, saying she misses him. When she looks up, she sees the words "here" written in steam on the bathroom mirror. She follows wet footprints into the bedroom and touches an invisible figure in front of her. It feels like Owen. She holds him and feels him touch her. A voice says, "Yes, he's really here," but it's not Owen. The bathroom door locks and she looks in the mirror, but it's not her. It's one of the other women. Then Owen comes in and she watches him attack her. He seems to see her and then the invisible figure attacks her too. Beth watches him drag another woman into the room. The ghosts of other women are hiding. The nothing, that's what I'm calling the void, is watching. She stumbles through the house and sees Owen attack other women, always with the nothing watching. She falls down the stairs and sees him sitting with a sleeping version of her in front of the fire at Christmas. As Owen, the nothing says he's what she felt the night her heart stopped, nothing. He says he went to Owen and whispered over and over in his ear to send her back, but he wouldn't. He sent the other women instead. She fights with the nothing as it attacks her, then lifts her up into the same position as the statue. She sees two moons, a red one and a white one, then passes out. The next morning, Claire gets to her house. She finds the door open, a bottle of brandy, and the mirror smashed, but Beth isn't there. She also notices that the gun is gone, and Mel hears her calling. Beth is still seeing the two moons. She's in the boat with Owen, who is looking at the note he left her. She asks where Owen is, and the nothing, as Owen, says he's gone. Owen thought he could protect her, but he was wrong. She was right. He says, "There is nothing. There's only me." She turns the gun to herself as Claire runs toward her, but then she hears Claire scream her name. Owen says it doesn't matter to let go, but Beth puts the gun down. Claire swims out to the boat and pulls her in the water. Mel is there to help them both into the dock. Beth and Claire hug on the dock, and Claire says she's safe now. Mel sees her looking at something on the water. He says there's nothing there. Beth says she knows, but we see a shadow on the water that looks like Owen sitting in the boat. Woo! And that's the Night House.
That is the Night House.
Yep. All right. Huh. Now let's do a feelings check. I have a feeling we may have quite a few feelings about this. This is when we share our first experience with the movie and how it makes us feel when we watch it. Mike, would you kick us off?
Yeah, I thought this was one of the best movies of 2021.
Yeah.
Bruckner is a very interesting filmmaker. I've enjoyed his stuff. I think he's done some of the VHS segments. Did the vampire one with, I think it's Hannah Fireman, which is really good. I think he did The Signal. It was his first movie with A.J. Bowen and a number of others. Obviously, he's behind Hellraiser in the reboot of Hellraiser. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of the visual language of Hellraiser. You can see that this is like a dry run for it in some ways.
Yep.
I caught this on a matinee with my wife last year, and I fell in love with it. Her, not so much.
Interesting.
My wife is really interesting because, like, she's brilliant. She's a psychologist, but when she's not working, she likes to shut it down. So, you know, something like this, she's like, eh, she'd much rather like see a comedy or something a little bit lighter. She's like, eh, I deal with enough heavy stuff during the day. I thought there was like a lot to chew on here, and it's just the exact kind of movie that I really love. It, to me, it's this really beautiful and accurate representation of like grief and depression. So much that it can be very difficult to watch at times. I think this would be a very natural double feature with The Babadook. I think they're like two similar side. They're like different sides of a similar coin is what I would say. At the same time, like a lot of times when you have these like trauma is the monster in this horror movie, they forget to be scary. And this movie does not forget to be like genuinely terrifying at times. The transitional scare when Beth falls asleep on Claire's lap and then the house comes alive on its own got me time and time again. The I'm not Owen got me this time. It was fucking great.
That even just gave me chills when you just said it.
And I think that Beth is this really kind of fascinating but incredibly difficult person to spend 2 hours with. Rebecca Hall is just extraordinary in this movie, especially given that she spends three quarters of it with nobody else to play off of. And what I find when I watched it, rewatched it for the show, is how she weaponizes her grief against other people. Like, she's really quick to cut them down with this like sarcastic or pithy expression. Like, she can just devastate people with this like raised, this way she like raises her eyebrows and just kind of sucks in her cheeks a little bit. Like don't even go there type of thing. It really reminded me of like Tilda Swinton in We Need to Talk About Kevin. Like, that's probably the best comparison I can make. I made this note that she looks like she's the smartest person in the room every time she walks into it and she knows it. This takes place in upstate New York, and I kind of want to know the research they did, because I've lived in upstate New York and I know that it is much less expensive than a lot of other parts of the country, but $250,000 for this house on lakefront property like this seems like the most unbelievable thing about this movie.
Oh yeah, especially now the market has just exploded.
And this is only a couple years. So it was kind of right in the height of home prices going through the roof.
Now, to be fair, if it was filmed even months before it released, like when we bought our house, it was already like $300,000 more 3 months later. Like, it just shot up, at least in Nashville. I don't know what New York was like, but so no, I don't know. It's been real volatile. But yeah, I was noticing that too. I was like, kind of like,
should we start looking? But the downside is you have to live in upstate New York, which I can tell you from experience, I did not love. I moved out of there in less than about 4 months. I moved back here. So, yeah.
Well, I did like that house.
Oh, it was beautiful. Ooh. So what are your thoughts, Jen?
I loved this movie. This was my number one from last year. And I put in all of my voting stuff with all of my non-horror Nashville critic friends. I was probably the only one that put it as my number one. But I was like, oh, it's so good. I saw this. I think I rented it when it came out, or like I watched it on VOD. And I'm really glad that I just watched it for the first time rather than waited till I was going to cover it, because I really loved just kind of letting this movie wash over me, you know? And I feel like, I'm really glad that we're going to talk about it, but I feel like there's so much of this movie that is feeling that this is the movie that the kind of movie that I just absolutely love. And I'm glad that I got the experience of just feeling what this movie is without really analyzing it yet. Because knowing what was going to happen, I was able to kind of look at it in a different way. But yeah, I absolutely loved this. As a former teacher, like I said, I had I lost someone on the last day of school. So that, like, this brought up a lot of, like, older memories that I'm over now. But, you know, I see myself and Beth in a lot of ways that I'm excited to talk about, because I feel like this really is a unique depiction of grief and depression. You know, like, it's not, I agree. I think Beth weaponizes her grief, which I think is really interesting, because I think that feels like defense, like a defense strategy to me. And I don't think the movie is ever shaming her for that, which I really enjoy. Like, I think she is really allowed to feel the gamut of emotions that she would feel in the wake of this horrible tragedy. I love, like, there are so many visual things about this movie that I just love. Like, his book of designs is so, like, soothing to look through. I could just see myself just pacing through this book, not even knowing what any of it means. It just, there's some symmetry that I find really satisfying. And yeah, she's also, she's from Tennessee too, so I gave a little, hey. You know, lots of times when Tennessee is represented in movies, it's not for the better. So
it's usually Deliverance.
Exactly. So I was really happy to see a cool person from Tennessee too. And yeah, I think a lot of what I have to say about this movie, I think, is going to come out in our talks, but it really hit home in a lot of ways. Cause I feel like it just felt like feeling seen in grief, you know? And it also scared the shit out of me. All right. Well, so let's transition into our mental health issue. And there is a lot here. So, Mike, what are we going to talk about today?
Yeah. So there's a lot of mental health issues on display in the Night House, and we've covered them in previous episodes. So we're going to kind of touch on them here a bit. Mm-hmm. What jumped out to me was the intersection between grief, depression, and suicide. Mm-hmm. And then there was like a hint of schizophrenia at the end as well, when like Owen explains, or the shadow that looks like Owen explains like what he did to manipulate him. Mm-hmm. The main focus here would be unresolved grief. And we explored this before way back when we discussed Friday the 13th in our first year of the show. Mm-hmm. And there is the kind of grief that is considered loss, or that tends to focus on the loss of the person itself. It can be on like the stressors that the loss has caused. So like the emotional weight or the sadness that comes when a person we lose that we love and we hold dear, and we can no longer rely on them being with us. There are other stressors as well that are involved with it, obviously. You know, Beth would go from a person that would have like a two-income family and a pretty well-to-do neighborhood to all of a sudden being on her own. Mm-hmm. Her emotional support is gone. That financial strain is going to become evident. And you do get, I mean, although you never see them interact together as a couple, like really see them interact, you do get from the anecdotal evidence and the photographs and how everybody talks about the two of them that it was like a happy marriage, and now that is going to be kind of taken away from her. Mm-hmm. What we see when folks tend to focus on the loss are things like looking at old photographs, imagining what the other person would think if they were there in the moment, constant crying over the death, and that reminiscence over a person can be pleasurable but also very painful as well. Mm-hmm. Usually when we start to move through our grief, or start to move past our grief and are able to put it behind us, usually that reminiscence is more pleasurable. We think of all like the warm memories and what they meant to us, and we kind of disassociate the pain from it as we begin to resolve it. Mm-hmm. During this movie, Beth shows like a number of signs of the grieving process. Number one is that social isolation, where she does spend time with Claire, but you sense that even when she's with her friends, that she's doing everything she can to pull away from them. Like, she just wants to go back to being alone. Mm-hmm. So that sense of isolation, that lack of focus and concentration, and that thing of like time getting away from her. We see this in the scene in her classroom, where she just nods off, like she's looking at Holmes one moment, and then she just disassociates. And when she is awoken from her kind of trance-like state, you see that she's been looking at handguns online, and there's like no accounting for that time. That emotional numbness and then like the lack of sleep and low energy. She wouldn't quite, because the wound is so fresh, because when this movie begins, it's only been like about a week since the inciting incident. So she wouldn't quite qualify for this yet, but you can sense it would happen where there's now what's called prolonged grief disorder. That's been added to the DSM-5, which is the manual we use for diagnosis as counselors, where that's been added this past March. And it's this idea that if you're unable to kind of face up to grief, or if it goes unresolved, it becomes complicated. It can be really difficult to assess this because sometimes the coping mechanisms we'll use to push grief away briefly can appear healthy, but can also appear really unhealthy. I kind of pulled a quote here from an article that I found called The Role of Avoidance in Complicated Grief. It's basically went into like a detailed exam. Like they're trying to come up with a questionnaire they can ask persons that are suffering to see if they're able to kind of maneuver through grief in a healthy way, or if by prolonging it, it can lead to depression, anxiety, or, you know, other stress-related disorders. So, quote I pulled up, and it kind of talks about complicated or prolonged grief here. It says, awareness of an ability to identify grief-related behavioral avoidance may be further impeded among bereaved individuals with complicated grief due to a unique feature of the complicated grief avoidance profile that differs from other anxiety disorders. So basically, a lot of grief and anxiety or grief and depression can look very, very similar. But there are some things that might set what complicated grief looks like apart from it a bit. Individuals with complicated grief may continue to seek out reminders of their lost loved ones rather than avoid them. For instance, many individuals will seek sensory experiences that help them to continue feeling close to the deceased, such as wearing clothes that smell like their loved one, listening to the loved one's voice on an answering machine, or looking at old photographs for long periods of time. Paradoxically, this behavior may reflect an attempt to avoid the absence of the deceased by seeking proximity to reminders to an extreme degree. So the things we see in The Night House, where she's going through the old text that she has with Owen. She's like going through all of his, going through his phone and going through all the photographs, rewatching the wedding video, playing their favorite song over and over again. You understand that during the initial stages of her grief, like because you want to feel that closeness to a person, it's hard to accept that they're gone. If that were to continue for a prolonged period of time, then you might start to see that as an unhealthy coping mechanism because they're not really dealing with the, not dealing with the reality that that person is no longer there, that they're using these items as a way to feel like, no, they're not really gone. I can still smell them on my clothes. I can still hear our favorite song.
Yeah. And that when I think about Lisey's story, which is another story about a woman who's lost her husband, Lisey waits like a year or two before she even goes into her husband's study. So it's, I think that would be an example of kind of denying that this has happened. You know,
we see that in like Stand By Me as well, with Stephen King, and it with like Georgie's bedroom never being touched and Gordy's older brother's bedroom. Like they get angry when he's in there. I think there's a passage in it where Bill's dad tries to remove some of the items from George's bedroom, and the mother basically goes into like a fit of like hysteria, and like dad just slowly puts the items back and they never address it. They never talk about it. So that would, things like that.
And it's interesting because I think both of those are natural responses, but I think what you're talking about is when it goes on for a prolonged period of time and keeps you, because like For me, there was a time when I did not want to look at any pictures of my first husband, and I put it off and put it off, and I threw mm-hmm. them all out. And then it started to become this big thing in my mind. Like, I was afraid to
right.
look at any pictures because I might have missed one or something. But then on the other hand, like, we see Beth, like, she's really not going to be able to function while mm-hmm. she's continuing to seek connection to her husband. So it's really, it's not necessarily that either of those things are bad. It's when they go on for long enough that they keep you from living your life.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And that is the thing with most disorders. Uh-huh. It's when the symptoms interfere with your ability to function, whether it's socially, whether it's at work, whether it's at school, mm-hmm. whether it's just keeping up like your personal hygiene, like when the symptoms affect your ability to just kind of function and get through your day, that's when it shifts from being a minor problem to a possible disorder.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I remember reading, so I follow a couple of Depression Nashville like Instagram pages, and one of them was like, remember to brush your teeth today, because that's something that I mm-hmm. tend to forget when I'm yeah. feeling really low, you know?
I have seen that before in like the work that I do, persons mm-hmm. that forget to get out of bed, can't get out of bed, or mm-hmm. if you ask like, when is the last time you shower? They're like, huh?
Yeah.
Maybe a few days ago. I don't know. I just didn't think of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's severe yeah. depression can have that effect on a person.
Yeah.
So what can this complicated grief look like? It can, number one, it lasts for a very long time. It's very severe. It can last for up to years, basically. It's very severe. It's very intense. Usually grief lessens over time. This, and it gives way to those happier memories. This doesn't do that. Like, this coalesces its grief into almost like a finely tuned instrument at that point that just hurts every time a note is plucked.
Can I ask a question about that? Because I think we're not necessarily talking about a mental illness in that some people are more predisposed to experience prolonged grief, right?
I mean, there are some factors, like there could be past traumas, there uh-huh. could be like social skill deficits or the inability to bond with others. Mm-hmm. There could be some genetic disposition to it as well. Like, where grief lives in the brain is different from where anxiety and depression lives in the brain. Mm-hmm. So there can be some determining factors, but it's not a one-to-one.
Okay.
I would say is just avoidance.
Right. That's what I was going to ask. Is this more about like not resolving your grief in a mm-hmm. healthy way? That's yes. what leads. Okay. It's not like you might accidentally just catch prolonged grief. I
no,
realize that
no,
sounds like I'm minimizing
like,
it.
But, yeah. You know. No, I get what you're saying. It's yeah, it's not something you're going to catch like a physical illness.
Basically. Okay. More about just not dealing with it in the right way to begin mm-hmm. with. Yeah.
Yeah. Or just dealing with it, period.
Like, right. Right. Yeah. The right period. Way feels like I'm being judgmental. But, yeah. You know,
which that's fine. We can be catty, judgmental.
I guess. Yeah.
And one of the things I came across when like reading for this episode is this idea of like new grief versus mm-hmm. sudden shock. And it doesn't quite apply here, but it was kind of fascinating. So I just want to touch on it. It
yeah.
Basically, because of these advances we've made in medical science, like we're living longer and we're also living longer with prolonged illnesses. So there's this opportunity when we get hit with like a medical diagnosis that we know is going to end our lives, that we could actually live with it for a fairly long amount of time before we truly suffer from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives us the opportunity to get our affairs in order, to say goodbye to persons, to reflect and reminisce on life. It's mm-hmm. you're less likely to now just like drop dead from a heart attack or heart disease. Like mm-hmm. things that used to kill us very quickly, we're now able to get through. And this new grief, what they call new grief, basically deals with the grief that comes before the absence or before the death, mm. where we are dealing with this like pending sense of loss and adapting to the new circumstances and what those circumstances will look like in the future. So,
interesting.
So that was what we were talking about. We talked about grief. Mm-hmm. Also with depression, which the other thing we see here, we kind of see that kind of in how they're entwined with one another mm-hmm. and how one of the dangers of complicated grief is that it can lead to severe depression down the line if it's not dealt with. Where depression differs from grief is with depression, it's usually something we face on our own. You know, we're responsible for getting ourselves out of bed, for brushing our teeth, for facing the day. Like the symptoms of depression, not that we don't have supports at all, but it's usually, and you hear it before. I mean, you've heard it from people. If you've been depressed, I'm sure you've had someone say, why can't you just snap out of it? Or why can't you just be happy? Or what do you have to be depressed about? You're so young, and things like that. But with bereavement, it typically comes with a support system. We have our family, our friends, our community. You see that at the beginning of this movie where it looks like it's probably one of her relatives, like someone that's like fairly close to her because they flew in for the funeral. So like, you can just call me. Here is some, the universal sign of a funeral is like giving someone a casserole dish. So we do see signs of depression here, like that being moody or irritable. That's a huge one for me. Like when I feel a depressive episode, I get way more irritable with other people. Same. You sense that irritation from Beth throughout this movie. Like she's on edge. Even the most innocuous interactions with persons can lead to like she's gearing for a fight is what she's gearing for. Like, and you see that in that scene with Hunter's mom, which I really, really love.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think about it like having a crick in your neck when I get cranky like that. It's like every movement hurts just a little bit. And so anytime somebody even passes me or bumps into me, it annoys me because it makes that crick hurt more, you know?
Yeah. So that's really it. I mean, we're going to talk about some other things as we go through the movie here and where we see how we see that grief play out with Beth and where we see some of those depressive episodes coming in. But I felt like grief in particular was really well displayed in The Night House. It was fascinating to watch it for this reason.
I think so too. And I think it is not what we're used to seeing grief look like too.
Yeah.
Which is what I really love. And just want to remind everyone, for really, really in-depth conversations about grief and depression, we have 4 episodes, 2 on grief and 2 on depression. And you know, one of them is Friday the 13th. One of them is The Babadook. And I can't remember I think we've got Lake Mungo.
We did The Invitation.
And The Invitation. That's right. Yeah. So we've got 4 separate episodes on this if you want a really, really deep dive. But I really like talking about them together because for those, we really tried to tease apart the two things. And I think this movie is a really great way to talk about both of them. The first thing that stuck out to me was sleeping on the floor and sleeping on the couch, which I've talked about before. Like that, I slept on the couch for a year after I got divorced. And I think listening to you talking about this, like, prolonged kind of trying to stay in touch with someone, I wonder if that's kind of what it was. Like, I get, because it's not just like I do it when I'm just not feeling great or there's some underlying thing that I'm really anxious about, because it feels to me like if I wash my face and I brush my teeth and I put my pajamas on and I get in bed, I am saying the day is over and I have accepted what has happened in this day as part of my life. And if I just fall asleep on the couch, then the day hasn't really ended yet. And I don't have to acknowledge that what happened during this day is real, you know? So I wonder if that is like an attempt for me to try to stay, if I were Beth, to try to stay in a day where her husband was still alive, or try to kind of prolong the period where she's not having to move on to the next day yet. You know what I mean?
I just think sometimes the bed seems so far away. Like there have been times like I probably fall asleep on the couch once a week or once every other week. And it's by choice. And it's not because I'm depressed or anxious, but there are times where like I am just so bone tired that I'm like, oh, I just don't want to get off the couch and go up the stairs and pull back the covers and fight with the dog to get to my spot and then pull up the covers. And that just seems like way too much to do. Maybe it is depression. Who knows? Whereas like I'm here on the couch, it's comfortable. I have a pillow. I have a blanket already. And sometimes I will sense that I know that I'm not going to have a good night's sleep. So I'll sleep on the couch because I just know that I'm going to wake up my wife by tossing and turning and getting up a lot. So sometimes it's just like when you're on there, especially in Beth's case where she's been like, you know, let's face it, drinking pretty heavily throughout this movie. Like she's already in a state at that point. And it can just, when you get so bone tired that just the act of lifting your head, forget about putting your feet on the floor to get up and walk up those stairs. Like it just feels like a lot.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think there's part of that too, is like, she is comfortable right now. She's found a place where she feels safe and comfy. Another thing that makes me feel really good is like fuzzy blankets and snuggling. And so if I have to lose that for a minute, then the bad thoughts or the negative thoughts or the realization that my husband's not upstairs might come in, you know, and this blanket on the couch feels like a way to protect myself from that. You know,
you see like in those opening shots, like by his part of the nightstand, it still looks lived in. Like there's like little wads of tissue paper. His book is out. Like it feels like he just got out of bed and went to work and he's going to crawl back into bed later on.
Yeah. She's even like kind of rubbing the indentation where his head was, you know, which is another thing. Like if I sleep on the couch, I don't have to admit that I'm sleeping by myself, which I think was part of me not wanting to go to bed when I was getting divorced. But yeah, and I also think there's just something comforting about a couch, like, or the floor. I don't know, wherever you happen to find temporary safety, you know, it's hard. It can be really hard to let go of that. I also really loved Mel. He reminded me, this is when I really thought about the Babadook, you know, because I was thinking about that elderly neighbor next door. And I think Mel is just so, such a sweet character. You can see he really wants to help her. And he knows what he's talking about, too. You know, he's like, he left a hole in your life. I feel like sometimes, like, I can imagine why Beth wouldn't always want to hear it, because sometimes it feels like he's explaining how she feels to her. But I also think it's probably helpful for her to, like, he's probably the best support that she could have aside from Claire, you know?
Yeah.
And he's in close proximity, too.
Yeah, Mel's fascinating, too, because he knows a hint of Owen's darker side. But doesn't really know the whole story. So he's also coming at it. I can see by the end of it of like Beth being a little wary of him, just because it would feel like to her he's withheld information and she could probably resent him for that. But at the same time, like what is Mel supposed to do with it? Like if I suspected my neighbor was having an affair, I don't think I would go to the partner and say, you might want to check on this. Like I saw him with somebody else, but I could see where she might even feel a little resentful of him, but he does seem like such a gentle person. It's hard to be mad at him.
It really is. And I mean, I don't know. I could see him. Yeah. Like not thinking it's his place. I also think that if it were a woman, if it was like Melinda, she might be more likely to tell Mel, and I realize that's, or she might be more likely to tell Beth. I realize that's probably oversimplifying things, but it almost feels like Owen comes to him that night and he's like, hey, I know you saw a fucked up thing, but like, I'm struggling with this and I've handled it. So I could see Mel thinking, oh, they're going to take care of it, you know?
Yeah.
And he's friends with Owen too. You know, he said like they were really supportive when his wife died, you know?
Yeah. But you're thinking if Mel was a woman, he'd be more likely to go to Beth.
I wonder, because I don't know. It depends on how close they are. I don't know. I think there's the fact that they're both men. It's like, this is a secret we have between men. I'm not going to tell your wife. Just, you know, I don't know. You know what I mean? I don't know how fair that is, but, you know. Like, what comes to mind is bro code, although I don't really think Mel feels like the kind of person with that would care a whole lot about that. And honestly, Owen doesn't really either. It just makes me, I don't know, it makes me think. I wonder if it had been a woman, if she would have come and told Beth. And I wonder if it would have really made much of a difference, you know? Like, because I think we know that Owen is not wanting to have affairs with women. And he's not, like, and we're going to talk about, I think, what his motivations are. but it's not about cheating and not wanting to get caught. It's about trying to appease this depression or this voice that he hears in his ear, or at least that's her interpretation mm-hmm. of it. So, which brings me to another point, like, we never actually see Owen when he's alive, and everything right. we see of Owen is either from this void that I feel like really lives within Beth, or it's Beth's interpretation of what she's found out about mm-hmm. Owen. So maybe we could talk about the nothing and like the emptiness, because that's what I love the most about this movie, is I feel like it really personifies this element of emptiness that feels like what depression and grief feels like to me. You know, it's like there is a, I think Mel says it, that he left a hole in your life, and that's what it feels like when you lose someone, you know?
What's interesting is like Beth talks about how there is nothing after you die. Like that's what she says mm-hmm. she saw, like mm-hmm. her heart stopped and it was just blank. It was like going into a sleep. But clearly there is something after you die, because there's at the very least this entity. Like it feels a bit like Final Destination. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really, this is like a more upscale version of that movie in mm-hmm. that like Beth cheated death. Like she was in this car wreck. She was technically dead and then she was revived. And ever since that moment, like death has come back for her. Like that's what this nothingness is. It's like wants to reclaim what it feels is rightfully its property at that mm-hmm. point, which is Beth's life.
Yeah. And what it made me think of was probably just because I said the nothing, but it reminded me of The Neverending Story, you know. And
never
like,
seen it.
Oh my God, it's so good. But the monster there is called the nothing, and it's just everything is gone and it destroys everything. And there's also this whole thing about the pit of eternal sadness or something, which is, we might want to cover it on the show at some point. It's not technically horror, but there's definitely some horrific elements. But just
be a patron episode.
Yeah, I'd do that. But just the idea that like that nothing is something you can feel, you know. Mm-hmm. And I love the way that note is written. It's because when you read it, knowing the end, you hear like you were right. Nothing with a capital N is following you, you know, which I think is just horrifying. And I've heard, you know, that like hell is the absence of love, and it's not like necessarily, and I mean, obviously nobody knows, but like, it's not a fiery pit where you're tortured forever and Homer Simpson is eating donut after donut. It's like there just is nothing there. It's we're done forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think it's terrifying, and it's gorgeous the way it plays out. Like just the voids in the house, you know, scares me every time. But I love the way that it shows. I feel like it really personifies the hole that he's left in her life, and how that hole can easily create a huge void that other things can sneak into, you know. Mm-hmm. Like Corey has, I think he's really worried about what would happen to me if he died. Like he's made me, that sounds bad, he's asked me to promise that I won't start drinking again if he dies. Mm-hmm. And he has said, don't ever sell the house, because this is what you're going to have to hold on to. And no matter what your finances are, you'll at least always have a place to live. And I think we kind of see, I can see that in Owen and in him trying to really protect Beth and really kind of giving his life to protect Beth, you know?
What's fascinating to me, there's a couple things that I want to talk about. One of the lines in the note in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find fascinating is that this nothingness doesn't try to get to Beth. It tries to get to her through Owen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it is about Beth. Maybe it's the fact that she believes that there is nothing, or she believes that it's just, you know, like turning out the light, basically. And mm-hmm. because of that belief that this entity can't get to her
mm-hmm.
in a straightforward way. But what he's able to do is go through Owen, who is a believer, who feels like there is something better after this world.
Mm-hmm.
And it tells, like the entity tells Beth at the end, like, I was able to whisper in his ear for years mm-hmm. over and over again. And that's where the schizophrenia comes in. Like Owen hearing this voice telling him like, hurt Beth. Give me Beth. You need to kill her for me. Mm-hmm. And it gets to the point where he can no longer ignore it. So he becomes a serial killer, really. Mm-hmm. And what it says about her, Beth and Owen's relationship, in that, like, she had no clue. Mm-hmm. She had no clue he was building a secret house across mm-hmm. the lake. No clue that he was leaving for long stretches at a time and, like, luring these women in to their home and then burying them across the lake under the floorboards of this fake house. Mm-hmm. And it was only able to get to Owen because of his belief and because he thought there was something out there. So it tries to get to Beth through him. I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting too. And I think my interpretation of that, it doesn't quite line up with the logic of the film, but that's where, what I mean when I kind of say I kind of feel this more than I really logically look at it. Like, I think because I'm a person who has come into my marriage bringing a lot of trauma with me, I think I look at it as like the weight of a supportive partner to deal with someone that has got trauma. And I think about like those minutes that Beth spent dead as like this, the nothing is her trauma that has followed her. And she finally found somebody to help her absorb all of that, you know, and that, and I don't know exactly how I feel about that lining up with Owen, like hearing the whisper in his ear.
Yeah.
But that when that is gone, she now has nobody else to help. She, one, has the grief of losing him, and also there's nothing to protect her from that trauma again.
Yeah, I don't know how traumatized she came away from that car accident. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's just something that she talked about in a very like matter-of-fact way. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it traumatized Owen, like if he got, you know, because we know with PTSD, one of the things is you can get PTSD basically secondhand, like from mm-hmm. being like from hearing about these experiences. And if he felt so traumatized by hearing her story of like, I died and then there was nothing. Mm-hmm. And that conflicted with his worldview that like, no, there is something after this of like having, because I could see that happening to me pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Like, even as we like talk about this, I'm like, what if this is just like, it's a big existential question that mm-hmm. I struggle with. If like just him trying to marry like his own beliefs and how they conflict with Beth's of that gave him like trauma basically. And mm-hmm. that's how this thing was able to get in. Cause Beth seems pretty matter of fact about it when she discusses it with others. Like mm-hmm. it's no great shakes.
Yeah. And I think it's hard to really tell when she's in this state because we never see her before Owen died. She does say that she was the one that had depression mm-hmm. and he was the one that helped me. So I know she's got thoughts, but I don't know how much of it actually stems from mm-hmm. the crash. That's just the one thing that we know. And again, this is a lot of this is my projection of my own story onto this, mm-hmm. you know, but I really think what I see a lot in Owen is just how hard it can be in a relationship with somebody that has depression or that is traumatized yeah. or, you know, and that it, and I mean, I don't know. I
found that he was doing it because he was trying to trick the entity.
Well, and I that's know.
Why,
yeah.
And that's why all of the women look like Beth. Like when she goes through the phone, she sees about a half dozen women that all like strongly resemble her in terms of her build, her features, their hair. And what it's trying to do is either offer up an alternative to this being or essentially just trick it until it thinks that, oh, you've finally given me what I wanted and now I can leave. And I think the realization that Owen comes to is that this being will always try to get to her through me. So therefore, I have to remove myself from the equation. So that's why I think like the line in the note where it says nothing is after you, it takes on a lot of different meanings depending on what word you want to emphasize. To me, what Owen could have meant it in a romantic way where it's like nothing is after you, that meaning after this relationship with Beth, there's nothing more that he's going to be wanting or longing for, that he's had everything that he could possibly want in his life. It's been fulfilled through her. And what else would there be? Like, imagining a life without her is too much, especially if he's the architect of that demise. Also, it could mean by taking himself out of the equation, nothing is after you. You could almost add the word anymore. Like, once he kills himself, he's able to keep her safe by removing himself. Because in reality, Owen poses the greatest danger to Beth without her even knowing it.
Yeah, but I think, like, as soon as he's gone, the thing immediately tries to come for her, too. Like,
oh, it's because he's wrong.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think that's one thing that it shows, like, kind of the fallacy in a lot of suicidal ideations, that things are going to be better when I'm gone. It's that, no, you've really just removed a piece of protection that you were giving her, you know? But
It's like in The Ring, when they feel, oh, if we just give Samara this place of rest, and you come to find out, like, no, that's not what she wants at all. Like, she's pissed off. Like,
right.
She wants more victims.
You weren't supposed to help her. Oh, my God. Right. I remember watching that in the movie theater for the first time and being like, oh, shit, I thought the movie was over. Fuck. Well, okay, so speaking of protection, I want to talk about Claire, because I just love Claire so much in this movie. She also is in Barry, and I love the character that she plays in Barry. I didn't for a while, and then I started to really like her. But yes, she is just really, she really cares for Beth. I feel like she's a really great support system. I feel like she is constantly saying, like, you really should stop looking through his stuff, like, really trying to help her, but not being pushy about it. Like, she doesn't come over and, like, take all of his stuff and throw it out. You know, she doesn't try to feel her grief for her or try to protect her from her grief, but she's just there for her, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she's such a good and supportive character. I love Barry as well, and I'm on the fence about her character of Sally.
Oh, yeah. Now, I haven't seen the third season, so I can't say yet.
It's very, I think I feel more sympathetic towards her after the third season, but I see her mostly as, like, a narcissist. Like, she,
I could see that.
Yeah. But I think that the third season definitely adds some layers to her. But as Claire, like, she's this incredibly empathetic person who clearly loves Beth as a dear friend and wants her to be okay, but also knows that it's going to take a long time for her to be okay. Like, she doesn't try to force herself on her. I think she's really good at seeing what Claire needs in the moment and offering it to her. And look, she never, like, she doesn't insist that Claire stays at her house. Like, she's an adult with autonomy. I'm going to trust her to go on her own. But she's also smart enough to know, like, when she doesn't turn back up, like she said, something could be wrong, and she makes her way out to find her. I think that line where she, like, just blurts out, like, I love you, is, like, really powerful.
Me too. And she doesn't seem, like, affected when Beth doesn't say it back either, you know? And I could see maybe Beth not wanting to stay at her house, because there's one scene where we see her husband and her kids in the background. And I think Beth suggests, okay, well, I'll go get a room and I'll stay somewhere else. But she doesn't push it, and she doesn't, like, she just says, I don't like the idea of you being here all by yourself, but she doesn't, like, move into the house with her or anything. She's there when Beth needs her. And I feel like she really navigates that conversation when the teachers are out drinking really well, too, you know? And that's another, I do want to talk about what you mentioned about her weaponizing her grief, but that moment when she starts talking about the soliloquy monologue, like, you can tell she is so protective of Beth, and she really doesn't want to push her, but also kind of lets her talk about it if she wants to. Like, she doesn't stop it or shut it down. She's just like, you know, I don't know. I just love her. She's a really good example of a supportive friend that I feel like we don't see that often in movies, especially between two women, you know? You mentioned trying to trick the depression, which I think is something that's interesting. It's like this kind of magical thinking. And I don't really have a well-formed thought about that, but that just kind of feels like a lot of kind of magical thinking I've tried to have. Like, if I just if I do this right, then maybe he'll come back. Or if I, you know, if I don't ever change my clothes, then maybe it's not real, mm-hmm. you know, or trying to, or if I sleep on the couch, then I don't have to actually feel this pain. And one of the things I think is the most powerful scene I found when I was watching it on rewatch was the scene where she actually starts crying on the floor, because it's the first time we've seen her really show any kind of sadness or emotion, you know, and it's like she just breaks down. And I got the sense, again, this could just be me projecting, but that she's been trying to hold that off for as long as she can, you know. Yeah. And in therapy, I've described that as like being afraid to open a door that I won't be able to close ever again. You know, you just feel like if I admit that I am sad, it's just going to come in a flood and just overwhelm me and I'll never be able to get back, you know. But I think when I was, what I hear you saying in our mental health topic is that by trying to avoid that sadness, that's what is leading to this prolonged grief mm-hmm. or complicated grief, right?
Yeah, I made a note that I'd be really curious to see what would happen to Beth after this movie ends.
Mm-hmm.
And I do like the fact, and I read, it's fine, I watched this movie like a day after reading an article by Mike Ryan a year ago talking mm-hmm. about how movies don't end anymore. Like mm-hmm. once the climax happens, you get these like 10-minute long codas that are tacked onto it that just kind of are either meant to set up a sequel or they just like don't know how to end it. And what mm-hmm. I really love about this movie is it ends just as like everything wraps up and you don't know what's going to happen to Beth after this.
Mm-hmm.
Up to this point, like investigating the causes of Owen's action, like first, like trying to unravel through this giant tangle of like secrets and deception and murder, it allowed Beth to not have to face grief head on mm-hmm. because she has something to do. Mm-hmm. Like instead of having to look at like, I feel sad and I feel grieving because like my partner like shot himself and killed himself unexpectedly. Instead of having to face that, she's like, oh, I found this random picture on my phone. Now, I think most people would look at that photo and think, oh, my husband took a picture of a woman who looked kind of like me. He was probably going to show it to me at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's kind of what most of us would think. Or
yeah,
it's just some picture. Random picture. Mm-hmm. And she creates this whole, and she's right. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. otherwise we wouldn't have a movie. But she's like, there's something behind this. There's a mystery here. I am now going to focus all of my energy on the mystery of this photograph. And it allows her something to do that takes her mind off the grieving process. Mm-hmm. What is she going to do without that sense of purpose? Like, how is she going to handle this going forward?
Mm-hmm.
And what is like resolving that grief going to look like? I put in here that there is... the complicated grief here is that sense of detachment that she seems to have, like looking at her husband as sort of a mystery to solve mm-hmm. rather than like a person that died. And I think that is what you're right, why the crying scene is so powerful, because mm-hmm. for the first time, she's able to kind of like see him
yeah.
or like see what happened to him and grieve that loss. And that just also happens to be the moment that the entity is able to kind of become even more personified and interact with her.
Mm-hmm. Which I think I also see as just kind of this grief building and building and building mm-hmm. and trying to overtake her, which is another part that I want to talk about.
Oh, I made a note here too. What makes it even more complicated going forward is what she uncovers. I mean, mm-hmm. there's this Owen that she knew, her husband who loved her, who cared for her, that was funny and charming. And, you know, he was like 8/10 of an Oscar Isaacs, basically, or Pedro mm-hmm. Pascal. He's like, looks like Pedro Pascal a little bit. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, if your mom, like, let's go for Pedro Pascal for dinner. Like, no, we have it at home. Like, that's what Owen looks like, kind of.
He's in Archive 81 also.
You know, I watched a couple episodes of it and. Mm-hmm. gave up on it, especially knowing it was canceled.
I
remember listening to the first episode of the show and mm-hmm. really loving it, but then falling off on it. Mm-hmm. But when you learn your husband has like what he's done to all these women,
mm-hmm.
it's also going to complicate things as well. Because now you have to also struggle with that. Like this is what he was capable of.
Well, and I was thinking too, like this is kind of another reading I see of it is just like the way, the spiraling nature of grief mm-hmm. and trauma, because every woman that he has killed sparks their own Beth, like they've probably have their own Beth at home, you know, mm-hmm. or somebody who's going to miss them, or somebody who is going to deal with all of this nothing because of yeah. their death too. And so it just feels like this never ending cycle of grief in trying to just not deal with the initial trauma or the initial depression, you know? Yeah. And I wonder if I did see that picture on his phone, what I would do. And I think it's hard for me to necessarily figure out if I take everything that happened in this movie at face value, you know, or if I read Beth as more of a an unreliable narrator, and some of this is like dream and some of it really happened. Like, I think there's a big part of me that doesn't want to believe that Owen actually killed these women, although I don't think there's any reason not to. But I think like the reason she goes and looks at his phone is because he sent her these texts in the middle of the night, you right. know? And so she's going to look at his phone to see if those texts are still there. Of course, if it were a dream and he never actually sent the text, then that could be her just kind of searching for a reason to look on his phone, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And that's how I would, you know, I think most of us would interpret it. Oh, I dreamt that my husband sent me these texts, and mm-hmm. then they're clearly not there the next day. Like, that would be the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was one other thing that I wanted to mention, and it was like, I think there's this really interesting doubling part of the story that's happening mm-hmm. that I think I could maybe, I don't know if this is a stretch, but I think it feels like Beth is watching someone else live her life, you know, yeah. or she's like watching herself in a movie, which I have not personally experienced, but I've heard that people that maybe are in shock or maybe mm-hmm. experiencing grief and depression, you know, it doesn't feel like your life is real at that point, you know?
It's like she's in a disassociative state, and you mm-hmm. see that in the scene where she first comes back from the mirror home and she walks in the door and then wakes up on the sofa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just thought that was so fascinating. And when she comes down the stairs and she sees herself asleep laying in his lap, you know, mm-hmm. and I just thought that was such a really cool visual way of getting at an experience that I think is really hard to describe, you know.
I also love the way that the nothingness fills up empty space. Like, there mm-hmm. are a few moments in the movie where, like, the early one, the bathroom reflection, where it's the outline of a person, and it's really, it's just like, it should be natural, but it looks so unnatural that it's very creepy. Mm-hmm. And you see that throughout the movie, where depending on where her eye is trained, it looks like it's the outline of a man. And it's like this entity filling the space where someone else should be. And I think it's mm-hmm. a beautiful visual metaphor, and it's just gorgeous and so creepy.
Totally. Well, and I think it is a really poignant thing too. Like, I remember the very first panic attack I ever had was when the show I was watching went to a commercial, and there mm-hmm. was, it's like what you were talking about, like when Beth doesn't have this mystery to solve, there's a void and she doesn't mm-hmm. have anything to distract her anymore.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, I kind of like that it ends when it does, because it ends in a place where Beth is safe for a moment, and she's safe and she's taken care of and she's surrounded by love. But I do wonder what the next day is going to be like, and yeah. that, and I think this is something she's going to continue to struggle with for the next maybe couple of years of her life. Yeah. But I think it leaves her in a place where I feel like she's got the support she needs, you know, mm-hmm. so that it's not necessarily a happy ending for her, but it's maybe as happy of an ending as is available to her right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I put down that I don't know if it's a happy ending, but it's a peaceful ending.
Mm-hmm.
At least she's been able to make a little bit of peace. Like, I didn't see a shadow of Owen on the lake. And I put that in the note here. And I went back and rewatched just that scene again after reading your notes last night. And I'm like, still don't see it.
I didn't see it the first time, but I did. And it could just be that it's a shadow and that I mm-hmm. wanted to see a figure, but I saw like the figure of shoulders and a head, like he would be sitting in the seat of the rowboat.
Sure. And I just saw like the elongated shadow of the boat on the water. Mm-hmm. So
and
I'll
it
go
could
back.
Just be that. Mm-hmm. But I kind of love that ambiguity, is, you know?
Because that ending to me is a lot darker. Like, to me, that's much, much darker.
Well, but that to me feels a little bit like the Babadook. Like, this yes. is always going to be a part of her life. And what she can do is she can look at it and say, no, there is nothing there. Mm-hmm. You know, even if she does see this nothing. I was about to launch into a whole, like, discussion about what the afterlife is based on what you believe. But I don't know. I think the important thing is that she didn't believe that there was nothing. And now she knows that maybe she's wrong.
Maybe,
you know,
she's more open to whatever the possibilities are.
Right. Well, it's really moving to see her feel like she has connected with Owen, you know, and it reminds me of this moment in Paranormal Activity 2 where the dad is saying, like, why would you want to contact the spirit? And the daughter says, well, what if it's mom, you know, this mother that's passed away? And it's just this really kind of striking moment to me, like, a ghost is a terrifying thing. Like, it's terrifying to think that there is an otherworldly entity in your house, unless it's someone you love and you can't connect with. And just that's why I think that it's not Owen line is so chilling, because mm-hmm. we think she has finally got what she's wanted. She's finally connecting with Owen, and to find out that it's not, it's really the worst thing she could imagine. It's just devastating. You know?
It's an intruder in her home.
Mm-hmm, exactly. But the worst kind of intruder, because you can't fight it. How do you fight this thing?
Right.
You know, you fight it with love and friendship. All right. Well, I want to talk about weaponizing grief, but yep. before we do that, do you want to talk about Beth and Hunter's mom?
Yeah. And I think that kind of ties into it here. So mm-hmm. both of us have worked in education, mm-hmm. so I think we really felt this scene a lot.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
I'm not a teacher. I'm a counselor. Mm-hmm. But a lot of my job, like a good probably quarter of my job, is reaching out to parents for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And it could be like, because teachers can be, you know, difficult to get a hold of, like they're teaching class. So mm-hmm. a lot of times, like, I end up being the go-between. Like, I will meet with the group of teachers and like go over different kids, and if something comes up, it's like, all right, I'll reach out, I'll call home. Mm-hmm. Or if a parent has a current concern, they might reach out and talk to me first, and then I'll relay it to the teacher. So I end up being the go-between a lot. But the biggest thing I struggle, I'm trying to be sensitive when I talk about this, like mm-hmm. what I find, like, the largest problem we have isn't the kids but the parents. And what I mean by that, and I think in this case, you see, like, Hunter's mom is inserting herself and basically blaming Beth for her son's performance when her son didn't do what he was supposed to. And mm-hmm. that's like, get the assignment in or follow up to make sure that, like, his makeup work was done. Mm-hmm. So, and what makes it more egregious is he's in high school. Mm-hmm. So he's now at the point where he's going to, like, pretty soon should be on his own anyway, and his mom is still fighting his battles for him. Mm-hmm. And what you find is, like, and I've said this before, when I was growing up, if you got a call home from school, it wasn't the question my parents gave is like, what did he do?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was like, I was responsible for what I did or didn't do. In this case, what you're finding is now more often than not, it's like, oh, how did you fail my son or my daughter? Mm-hmm. And it's like the kids are not held accountable by the parents at all. And if I can't get a kid, I'm sorry, if I can't get a parent to care about how their kids are behaving, if the parent doesn't care, nothing I'm going to say to the kid is going to have any impact whatsoever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who gives a shit?
Right.
So I found, like, mom coming in and being like, well, how dare you take a personal day when my son, and what did she want? Like, I think Beth is great. She's like, all right, you didn't want to be like, what was the point of you coming in? Like, if you didn't want me to improve his grade, like, I can easily say, oh, he missed this assignment, I wasn't here that day. You know what? He would have gotten a B otherwise. Great. Mm-hmm. No problem. The mother wants to punish Beth mm-hmm. for being out. And mm-hmm. I actually did just say this to a parent last week where they didn't do something they were supposed to. Like, well, you didn't call to give me a reminder. And I'm like, sorry, I was at a cardiology appointment with my 12-year-old, but I did give you all the information the last time we talked. I actually was thinking of this movie because I knew we were covering it. And it just like, it really pissed me off. Like, how dare you don't, you know, you had all the information. You just chose not to use it.
Right. Well, and it feels like exploiting her grief, too, because, like, I'm sure he didn't show up on the last day of school ready to give her his presentation. Mm-hmm. He just happened to see that she was out and was like, oh, hey, here's how I can get my grade, you know? And it's also not to diminish speech as a class, but, like, it's an elective. Like, it probably doesn't even matter, you know? Right. It really is just to punish her for daring to give him a C, you know?
Yeah. And she doesn't even know. And I love when she's like, oh, you wanted an A? Here you go. Here's an A. I love that how quickly, because you see like her, the mother is just so smug, right? Just like so self-righteous, like I'm going to put this teacher in her place. And then you see that crumble away. And I think that's like Beth's superpower is like she can be vicious.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, even if she was just out because she was sick or even if she just took a day off, you know, I think teachers deserve to have that kind of autonomy. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't owe everything to our students, and it's not our fault if a student missed an assignment. And I think that's what she's implying when she's like, well, we all have personal matters. Well, your kid is a student, and his job is to do his work, you know.
Yeah.
It made me very angry. That said, I also had some depression issues in college, and my mom called and registered for me for classes once when I had missed the deadline. So I've definitely done that before, but I think that was a function of my own depression, not me just being lazy or my mom wanting to protect me. It was like I just could not handle this, you know. Like I once paid my ex to put my Christmas tree down because I was like, this is just too much, I can't do this, I need to fall asleep on the couch. The day that I missed, I still do kind of have some guilt about this because it was the last day of school. It was our fourth grade celebration and my choir was supposed to sing, and they did sing and they sang without me there to conduct them. And, you know, I missed it and I still feel guilty, but it's something that happens as human beings. And, you know, sometimes we just miss things and the world kept turning and those kids, I'm sure, are fine. So
probably haven't given it a thought since then.
They probably haven't. And if they have, then I think that's a symptom of another kind of problem, like Hunter's mom being so concerned about this one grade and taking it out. Okay, so I do want to talk about this weaponizing grief because I think I hadn't thought about it in concrete terms. I think it's clear that that's what she's doing. And I love the scene with her and the teachers because I think it just shows how people really struggle to talk to people who are in the midst of depression and grief. And something we talked about in one of our other episodes is what to say to people and how to offer support in a way that is not going to feel like, oh, look at all the things that you have that's great in your life. Like, that's not going to help, you know? So if you're wanting some concrete suggestions for that, check out, I can't remember exactly what episode it is,
but it was The Invitation.
The Invitation, that's right, that's right. Yeah, that's such a good
I mean
movie.
The number one thing you can offer is what you see Claire do here, like here are some options, I love you, I don't know what you need right now, but I'm here to offer whatever it is I can for you, and I love you and I'm here to support you. It's like the most important thing you can do. What I found with like that bar scene was like, people get very uncomfortable when you're not grieving the way they expect you to. That was what that discomfort was. You see it with two of the teachers specifically. Like when Beth whips out the note and reads it, and when she starts using like that gallows humor, like she knows what she's doing to them and she doesn't give a fuck. Like she knows how uncomfortable she's making everyone at that table. And it's almost like we've talked about self-harm before. It's like you cut yourself or pinch yourself or do something just so you can release all of these big feelings. Like this is like almost a form of self-harm. It's a way for her to release this feeling of like anger and shame and sadness and grief that's welling inside her. She's like turning that outward and she's able to kind of cut at others by acting in this way.
Yeah. And it's also a way to push people away, too, because they might make you actually deal with your grief in a way that you don't want to, you know. I kind of read it a lot as a defensive kind of thing. Like, if you can put them on the defensive and make them feel bad, then mm-hmm. you don't have to see their pity reflected back on you, you know, and you don't have to kind of share in this sadness that they seem to think you need to be feeling. But yeah, it just, it's a really hard scene to watch, and I really feel for those teachers. But sometimes those are the conversations that you just, that's what's going to happen. You know, it's mm-hmm. hard to really know what there, a lot of times there isn't a right thing to say, and right. just showing up and not being offended. I think when somebody lashes out like that in the midst of grief, because I'm sure she didn't mean it personally to those two teachers. I also kind of saw it a little bit when she was talking to Madeline. Now, granted, mm-hmm. she's got a right to be angry with Madeline, although I don't think Madeline, I think it's implied that she didn't know that Owen was married.
Yep.
But I could completely understand her being angry with her. But just the look in her eyes throughout that entire conversation is like, oh, you can say his name. Yeah.
Yeah, he was my husband, not yours.
Exactly. That, yeah, yeah.
Even mm-hmm. before that, when she confronts her in the bookstore mm-hmm. and it's like, yep, he's not here anymore. Like, and she makes like the gun to the head mm-hmm. motion. Like, she knows exactly what she's doing.
Yeah. I also kind of read that as a, like, if you don't laugh, you cry kind of thing, like taking a different, like, if I can say it in a way that feels not so depressing, maybe it won't make me as sad to say it, you mm-hmm. know? So, because sometimes the words just are really hard sure. to say. But yeah, man, Rebecca Hall is just fantastic in this role. I've never seen her in anything that she's bad in, mm-hmm. But she just, this movie is just so incredible because of her. And if, like, this lives and dies on her performance, you yeah. know. I also want to recommend Resurrection because she's great in that.
She's great in that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just, the big takeaway from this is, like, see at the very beginning when she throws out the casserole, and like, that is like the universal sign of grieving, like mm-hmm. after a funeral. Everybody brings you a ton of food because they figure you're going to be so depressed, you're going to forget to eat. You're going to mm-hmm. forget to take care of yourself. And again, that ties into this idea of like how depression works, like not being able to just do the basic necessities to get mm-hmm. through your day-to-day life. So people bring you food. And the first thing she does when that person leaves is open the trash and dump it right in, mm-hmm. saying, I am not going to grieve the way you expect me to. I am going to go through this the way that I need to.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of read an element of like, I don't want your pity also, you know. Although I did notice on second watch that she is eating out of a casserole dish while she's sitting and watching the wedding videos. I don't know if it's the same casserole dish.
Oh, I'm sure she has a refrigerator.
She probably does. Full of casseroles. Full of them. But yeah, I've definitely rejected pity. And I think she also probably has a big, lots of feelings of guilt because she didn't see it coming, you know, and and they even ask her like, really, you didn't know what was going to happen? And the question behind that is, how could you not know? You
yes. know,
which I'm sure she hears, even though they didn't say it out loud. So there could be an element of like punishing herself by not wanting to feel taken care of by other people, or not wanting to let herself grieve because maybe she doesn't deserve to grieve. Maybe she deserves to still be in pain, you know? Although, I don't know, grief is another form of pain. There's just a lot here. And I think it's, again, this movie, I think is, I get more out of it feeling it. You know, when I start to pick it apart, I start to really wonder what is real and what is not. And I don't really think that's the point. You know, I think the point mm-hmm. is, this is, we see a loss, and this is a pretty authentic way of what this loss looks like, you know, even if the ghost is real or not. Is there anything else we want to talk about before we move on?
I think I'm good. I think we pretty much hit all of the key things.
I think so too. We talked about a lot of mental health topics. I don't know if there's anything we haven't mentioned that you wanted to note.
Nope. I feel pretty good.
All right. Let's mention any other movies we see this in. We already mentioned The Babadook. We mentioned The Invitation, which I think would make another interesting pairing with this. I want to recommend Hellraiser, David Bruckner's Hellraiser. It's not about grief or depression, but he tackles addiction in a very similar way. You know, I feel like there's a really kind of digging into a non-traditional way and how it feels, you know?
It feels like addiction is how it punishes the people around, how your choices as an addict punish your loved ones.
Mm-hmm. And the guilt that causes.
Love that message.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, I just saw myself and a lot of my experiences in it, you know. I definitely think it is a gorgeous movie.
It is.
And like you said, like there's a lot of that visual language that we see, a lot of overlap. They feel like cousins, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, and speaking of one of my favorite movies of the year, Hellraiser, and now it's time for an uplifting moment. This is where we share any grounding and coping techniques or any self-care that's been particularly effective for us. Grounding and self-care are little tips, tricks, mantras, or practices that help us get through the hard days or hard moments. And self-care is anything we do that makes us feel good or feel better. I've been binging Wednesday. I really, really enjoyed it. I wasn't expecting to really like it that much, and it kind of annoyed me for the first 15 minutes, and then I started to get into it, and I just really liked it. It's really fun. I wouldn't say it's dumb, but it's like, it's light, you know, and there are some cool visuals, and I've always thought of myself as Morticia, but I think I might be more like Wednesday, because she just sees the world through a darker lens, and mm-hmm. so do I, and I just love it. So check out Wednesday. It's on Netflix. There's also this really dumb show called Blood, Sex, and Royalty, which is about Anne Boleyn, if Anne Boleyn was like a real housewife, and it is hot trash, but it's real fun. So.
I was going to say, that sounds awful.
Oh, it's not great. It's not technically good, but I've spent a pleasant afternoon watching it.
Okay. So. Would you say, where does Wednesday fall for Tim Burton in terms of like his visual flair? Is it go back to kind of what we knew him for with like Edward Scissorhands and Batman and Pee Wee? Or does it feel like latter day Burton, where it's just kind of like, Disney gave me a bunch of money or Netflix gave me a bunch of money, and it feels very like commercialized or corporatized?
I would say it probably feels closer to the early years. Now, I say that as I'm not a huge Tim Burton fan, because I feel like a lot of it is too twee for me, you know. It definitely still feels like it's grounded in reality, and it's not weird for the sake of being weird. If I didn't know it was Tim Burton, I don't know if I would have picked up the Tim Burton-ness of it. So yeah, it feels more grounded than like the Willy Wonka movies and you know, all that I just don't have any time for.
Yeah, those are just like eyesores.
Uh-huh.
But you go back, if you watch like Ed Wood or Edward Scissorhands, even Batman, which owes like a lot to like German Expressionism
mm-hmm.
in terms of like how he designed Gotham. Mm-hmm. There was like a real vision there, which I mm-hmm. just think has been really everything after Sleepy Hollow seems to kind of be to be lacking in that.
This one feels a little more like Sabrina, the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina and Riverdale, kind of. It's got more of that tone to it.
Okay. I like one of those things. one of the great kind of like sneaky, like I think it was the first year I went to the New York Horror Film Festival. I had that like Saturday morning before movie started. I went to the Museum of Modern Art
mm-hmm.
in New York, and they were doing a sneak preview for like members of like a Tim Burton collection, basically, mm-hmm. which I did not know was happening. And I just like snuck into it and mm-hmm. walked around it for a half hour before they like caught me and made me leave.
Nice.
But it was just like really fun seeing all the old props and designs. And
mm-hmm.
I guess like it's the holiday season, like as mm-hmm. right now we're into December, so we just had our Thanksgiving. Like I spent the Saturday after Thanksgiving, because we didn't take leftovers home, like whipping up like another feast for the family. And it just was like a nice 5-day break for me of just like getting the house in order and like mm-hmm. putting together a list of all the projects we need to get done in the next couple of years, which I guess has me freaked out because of how much it's going to cost. But just kind of like, it's the end of the year, taking some time to like get everything in a row and lined up, so when next year starts, we can kind of hit the ground running, but like mm-hmm. using this month to kind of take stock of like where we've been. And that's at work, that's at home, that's with this show, that's mm-hmm. with my other show, just like assessing where we are. And then like, all right, how do we make this even bigger next year, and getting mm-hmm. like really excited for that.
Nice. Well, we want to hear from you. Do you live in a beautiful house down by the lake that costs shockingly little? Have you ever been in a rowboat? And what's the weirdest thing you've ever found in your partner's personal belongings? Or just what's on your mind? You can answer all of these questions and more by following us at PsychoAwayPod on all the socials. And you can also email us at psychoaypod@gmail.com if you want to share privately. And our homework question for this week. So we talked about Mel and we talked about Claire. Tell us about your support system.
Yeah. And when you think of that, like I just made a quick note here. Sometimes it's hard to think of the top of your head, like what does your support system look like? So mm-hmm. a question I ask at every intake now is like, who do you share good news with?
Ah, interesting. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something I think of, like, who's the first people you think of, like, when something good happens?
Ah, I like that. Yeah, because I guess, like, sometimes you don't really know who your support system is until you need mm-hmm. it, you know? Yeah.
So that's why, like, a lot of times, especially with anxiety, we write up a game plan. Mm-hmm. And part of that includes, like, who are three people you can talk to if you need to talk about your anxiety.
Yeah. You know, at the end of my MDR sessions, my therapist has been saying, all right, what are you planning to do for the rest of the day? Mm-hmm. Which I imagine is similar. It's usually like eat Taco Bell and go to bed. Yeah. But, you know.
That sounds lovely.
It has been very nice sometimes. All right. So next up for us, as a sort of a Christmas present, we are each going to choose a movie to talk about. And our first pick is Mike. So, Mike, what movie are we watching next?
Yeah. So we get the dealer's choice. Like, I have one, then Jen, and then that'll wrap up 2023, which is shocking. 2022. I know. Wow. Oh. So I have chosen, like, one of my all-time favorite indie horror movies. It's probably one of my 10 favorite movies. If you wanted to, it's as punk rock as it gets, I think, mm-hmm. in terms of just like when you think of the do-it-yourself aesthetic. So it is from 2013. It is a film called The Battery, written, directed, and starring Jeremy Gardner. And we'll talk a lot more about it next week, like what went in to making this movie. But basically, it cost him $6,000 to make it, and it looks better than productions that cost like 100 times more than that. I just absolutely love this like movie about two people wandering through the zombie apocalypse and the friends or enemies they meet along the way.
Nice. Well, I have not seen this, so I'm excited to watch it. And so that is The Battery from 2013. But for even more of us, Mike, what's going on in the world of Patreon?
So if you want more of us, go to patreon.com/psychoanalysispodcast. And let's say hello to a few new patrons right now. Let's say, first off, let's say welcome back, Julia. She was a patron before, and she is signed back on with us. Let's say welcome aboard, Brian, and welcome aboard, Anna. So we had a few people join us this past week. We really appreciate that. We hope you are enjoying the content that's up there. And we put a little pause through the end of 2022, so we haven't charged anyone, but that'll kick back up. You know, by the time you hear this, if you become a patron, you'll be charged in January. But we have bonus shows that are up there. We tackle different movies, TV shows, subject matter. All the levels get you some bonus content, all the way up to about 40 hours of it so far. And I will say, like, starting next year, like, the goal is to get more patron content up there to make it something that just we want to, like, drive some people to it. Right now, we have a number in mind of how many we'd like to see by the end of next year. But it's really fun. We do, like, our medicine chest, which is the things that we recommend. We have our treatment plans, which is where I look at a character from a movie, give them a diagnosis, and then here's some potential ways that I would treat them. We have a ton of different little bonus things that are up there, and we're always looking for new stuff that we can put up there that we're going to kind of get into as we get into 2023. So go to patreon.com/psychoanalysispodcast. Become a patron today. It's a very easy way to support the show, hear more of us, and kind of help us keep bringing this to you.
Nice. And now let's wrap up with some plugs. And I will go first, since you just plugged our Patreon. So you can find me at Jim Ferratu on any social. If I'm on it, I'll be at Jim Ferratu with two N's. I don't know what I'll actually use. Right now, I've mostly just been using Instagram. But who knows? I also started a Substack. I haven't written anything yet, but you can follow me there. And you can find me co-hosting the Losers Club podcast. Earlier today, we did an episode on trivia, Stephen King trivia, which was really fun. And we are also, the last episode in the Dark Tower series is coming up soon. So that should be really exciting. And you can also
flew through that.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't on them, so I didn't have to read all 2,000 of those pages. But yeah, they did the last three just in 3 months. So that's been a real heavy lift for them. But they love those books, so. And then you can find me on the White Ladies in Crisis podcast. And we're going to do a Hallmark Christmas movie for December, which is a different kind of horror for me. So I'm excited to talk about that. That's going to be fun.
I don't remember. Are you a Christmas person?
No, not really. Okay. I mean, I don't know. My neighbor said it perfectly, that Corey is to Christmas what I am to Halloween. So okay. We balance each other very well with that. Yeah.
Same in this. It's same in our household as well.
Yeah.
Halloween and Thanksgiving for me.
Yeah. I don't hate Christmas, but I don't know.
Corey, are you going to see the new David Harbour evil Santa?
Fuck yes. I already have tickets. Oh, dude, okay. I'm so excited. Yeah. I love Christmas horror movies. Like, I like those better than Christmas movies.
There's a Grinch horror movie coming out,
really?
Apparently. Yeah, Horror Queers posted a link about the trailer coming out tomorrow. And I'm like, I am fucking in on this movie.
I have listened to The Grinch 50 billion times because my son is obsessed with it. Like, Corey found an audio version, and so we listened to it in the car when we're driving around. Looking at Christmas lights, so I could say that entire thing with all of the inflections and everything. So I'm excited to see. I mean, I'm used to it, but like, it almost, I don't even hear it anymore, you know, but I would be interested in seeing a murderous Grinch. Mm-hmm. So what about you, Mike?
So you can find, let's see. Oh, we should say this for our listeners. Go to our Facebook page. We have about 400 or so active members in the Facebook group. I know, because you and I don't post in there that much.
I know.
But I've been going back to it a little bit more recently. And like, in just like getting some good feedback from folks, like basically like, what do persons want to hear from us in the future?
Mm-hmm.
And like, they were giving us some great movies and topics that they want us to explore. It was basically allowing the listeners to do our work for us. But it's an active group. So go to facebook.com, look up Psychoanalysis, a Horror Therapy podcast. And we have like a well-moderated group that is there. It's, you know, not your typical experience you get on that website. You can find me over at Hive at Mike Chump Change.
Ooh.
That's all one word. So yeah, I made the jump to Hive. It seems pleasant. It's a little slow. I don't quite get 100% how it works, but it's only like a couple people running it apparently right now. But if you go to Hive, I'm at Mike Chump Change. And I'm just basically following like my horror friends in that community. And it seems very pleasant right now. I'm now on Instagram at Mike_Snoonian. I have not done Mastodon because I can't quite figure it out. But, you know, that's the places you can mostly find me. If you want to hear more of me, go to The Pod and the Pendulum. You can go to podandthependulum.com, and that way you can link from there to all of the podcatchers. So whatever yours is of choice, we're on Apple, we're on Spotify, we're on Amazon, we're on Google. Pod on the Pendulum is my other show where we look at horror movie franchises. As this comes out, we're probably just recording our first episode on Phantasm. Nice. We have our year-end top 10 list coming out. And as soon as we end this call, I get about 20 more minutes left to edit of our Orphan First Kill episode that Devon Taylor and I did together. Nice. So some really fun stuff going on at the Pod of the Pendulum. So yeah, you should definitely be listening to that.
Awesome. And that is our episode on The Night House. Thank you so much for joining us. I want to give another huge shout out and thank you to William for choosing this movie and topic. I feel like this is a movie that really just kind of screams psychoanalysis.
This is, know? Yeah. This
is very much an us movie, you know.
I think I texted you and Lara coming out of the theater last year, like, hey, we're going to be covering this at some point.
I think so, yeah. And I'm glad we finally got a chance to. So thank you, William. And listeners, thank you for spending time with us. I know this was not the easiest of topics, but I think, again, these are conversations that we need to keep having because it makes it easier to have the next one. Please make sure to take care of yourselves and take care of each other. And with that, let's sign off. We came here to chew bubblegum and take care of ourselves. And we're all out of bubblegum. But we do have some trash casserole.
Oh.
Trasherole.
Oh.